You're listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. When I think of my dad all those years later, it is not his old, weak, confused face that I see in my mind's eye, but the bright, excited wonder of someone who had experience with something truly out of this world. Though, at first, I never believed his story. Until now. Angel Song, written and narrated by Nick Treadwell, inspired from a song by Mark Cohen. It was over the course of a few nights in October 1973 that the Midwest of the United States experienced a UFO flap that ignited the imagination of the country. Reports of strange objects, craft, and even non-human beings flooded local newspapers, TV stations, creating fear, panic, and confusion. Here, in the state of Ohio, residents reported seeing all manner of strange phenomena. John J. Gilligan, then Ohio governor, had an encounter with an amber-colored craft for 30 minutes while driving with his wife. Ohio police took reports from panicked mothers who believed the strange lights zipping over their house were out to take their children. In Columbus, 21-year-old Jesse Dunnigan, an Air National Guard flight controller, told police he saw a pulsating, bluish-white object 500 feet above Hall Road when it suddenly darted across the soybean field, hovered, and dropped straight down. Newswire United Press International reported a hysterical screaming woman from Highland County who told authorities an oblong craft with blinking lights killed two cows as it landed on her farm. Redding City plunged into darkness, experiencing several power outages. In Trenton, some swore a UFO craft landed on Main Street. And then there is the strange green light that buzzed a military helicopter captained by Larry Coyne, which was traveling from Columbus to Cleveland. The light stopped short of colliding with the helicopter, scanned the passengers, and then flew off toward Mansfield, leaving the crew shocked when they discovered they were 2,000 feet higher than they should be. Many of those strange accounts have been passed down through generations of families, including my own. You see, my father, Eric Gillen, claimed to have had a close encounter himself back in our hometown of Zanesville in October 73, though at the time I refused to entertain its authenticity. It's not that I thought he was lying, just that I put it down to the confused imagination of an old man. You see, mentally and physically, he had been in a bad place, having battled with Alzheimer's disease for 7 long years. The illness was in its advanced stages and he needed constant nursing care. Over those years, I watched as the father I loved and knew was cruelly robbed of his identity, unable to function in society, let alone look after himself. I had to make the difficult decision to have him placed in a nursing home. Despite regular visits with my own family, he had to be constantly reminded who he was and who we were. Most of the time, he inhabited a world of confusion. Linear time for him became jumbled, and you never knew which version of him you would get when you turned up at the home. But despite his fragile state of mind, there was always one subject that managed to bring a sparkle back to his eyes, to bring that little piece of him back to us. You see, he had grown up with a love of science fiction stories, which had fired his imagination as a child. He loved all those classic H.G. Wells and Jules Verne books, which he would later read to me as bedtime stories. When I got older, we would obsessively watch monster movies and creature features together, though his favorites were always the ones set in outer space. Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, Buck Rogers, and later Forbidden Planet, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. We saw a lot of those films down at the Liberty Theater on 5th Street, south of Main Street. Come rain or shine, we'd be there, chomping on popcorn and glued to the screen. Since childhood, he had loved stargazing and always owned a telescope. So, even in the nursing home, I had his telescope set up for him in his room by the window. I can never remember a time in his life when he wasn't entertaining the idea of alien life, of starships and strange worlds beyond our own. I was somewhat thankful then that before his condition deteriorated completely, he was able to witness the moon landing of 1969. Dad was so excited by the prospect of man walking on the lunar surface, especially as one of his all-time favorite books was From the Earth to the Moon. He became so animated by the whole thing that we even thought that the illness had slowed. But how wrong we were. Less than a year later, he was unable to string a sentence together and could no longer recognize his own grandson. For Christmas 1971, I got him one of those new cassette recorders with a built-in microphone, hoping it might encourage him some to set down some of his own thoughts. Of course, you never get used to the idea that your father doesn't know who you are. But by the time November 1973 had rolled around, I had fostered as best as I could some acceptance of the situation, and had fallen into the routine of visiting him in the care home as much as time would allow. By now, he was the grand old age of 75. On that fateful day in question, Friday, October 26, I turned up at Abbott Home on Greenwood Avenue around 2 in the afternoon, having gotten off work early. I found Dad sitting motionless in his room, staring out of the window. The autumn leaves were still falling from the trees in the gardens, which made for a serene and peaceful setting. I sat beside him, touched his hand and said, "Hi, Dad, it's Will. How are you doing today?" There was no response, not even a nod of acknowledgement. If he was lost in thought, I was unable to tell. Again, I offered gentle conversation, even though I knew I would get no response. "Bit cooler today, Dad. Seems like winter's just around the corner. Martha and David both send their love, and will come over one evening in the week. Anyhow, how about we get back to the moon?" I was reading him From the Earth to the Moon. I opened the book where we left off and began reading. On the completion of the Columbiad, the public interest centered on the projectile itself, the vehicle which was destined to carry the three hardy adventurers into space. As normally happened, I noted a flicker in his eyes, and he turned his head toward me. He was listening attentively. I continued reading for about another 45 minutes before I was interrupted by his nurse, who announced it was time for his afternoon nap. I closed the book and made a move to place it on the bookshelf, but was stopped by a hand clasping my wrist. Dad was looking longing at me. Obviously, he didn't want me to stop. "Don't worry, Dad. I'll be back tomorrow, and we'll polish off another chapter." A little nod, and then he turned blankly back to the scene outside. On the drive home, I listened to the local radio news. I don't know whether it was the closeness to Halloween or just the loony season, but there were all kinds of strange reports and rumors of bizarre sightings of lights in the sky flooding the airwaves. It had been going on for a few days, and I wanted to mention it to Dad as I knew it would get a reaction out of him, but I stone cold forgot. I noted there were storm clouds forming on the horizon as I pulled into the drive of my apartment, and the forecast said it was going to be a very wet night. It was 4:20 in the morning when I was woken by the phone ringing. My heart nearly jumped out of my chest when I learned it was the home. I suspected the worst. However, what I was told was not what I was expecting. Was it really true? Dad had been found lying on top of his bed in the middle of the night, soaked through with his slippers covered in mud. Surprisingly, though, he was all right. In fact, I was told he was as coherent as he'd ever been, that he was talking and remembering things that had previously eluded him. As soon as I got off the phone, I drove over there to see him for myself. I didn't want to leave things until the morning, because by then, he could have easily have reverted back to his old confused self. I needed to see this change for myself, and as soon as possible. By the time I arrived, it was just getting light. I found him sitting up in bed, his eyes bright and alert. And on seeing me enter the room, he immediately called out my name, and in a way I hadn't heard for a long time. As a father acknowledging his son, as I walked over to his bedside, he held out his arms longingly toward me, with tears in his eyes. We embraced. He gave out a long sigh and whispered, "Oh, Will, I'm so pleased to see you." I was shocked and taken aback. It was like some part of him had found its way back from somewhere deep and dark. For the next few hours, we talked, just like we used to. He, excited to tell me of the night's events, launched into an account of what had happened. But what he told me was so fantastical, so unbelievable that I just couldn't comprehend that it could be true. That he, being a confused old man, had walked in torrential rain in the middle of the night along Greenwood Avenue toward Mount Olive Cemetery, some 2 kilometers, where he had encountered something strange and otherworldly. As he told me the story, I nodded sympathetically and humored him, but by the disappointed look in his eyes, he knew that I wasn't really buying any of it. Of course, he was checked over by a doctor in the following days, who confirmed that there were no physical traces to back up Dad's story. So instead, I chose to believe that he had gotten up in the middle of the night and somehow wandered outside, unable to get back in. But something extraordinary had happened. Somehow, his memories had been reinstated with a clarity of detail that was crystal clear, and nobody, let alone his doctors, could explain why. They just put the whole thing down to some kind of short-term relapse, and that there was not enough research into the illness to determine the cause or how long it would last. In the following weeks, Dad constantly tried to convince me of his story, to make me understand what he'd experienced. But I just assumed that, along with his old memories, his old self with his vivid imagination and habit of embellishing the truth had also returned. On one of those occasions, I asked him what really happened. The truth, so to speak. He looked deep into my eyes and said, "I saw an angel that night. While everyone slept soundly in their beds, I was visited by an angel." It wasn't until a few days ago, some 7 years later, in early December 1980, that I really understood those words. You see, I had a visit from a stranger, an elderly man who said he had something that belonged to me. He took out a cassette tape and handed it to me. He said he'd picked it up at a flea market in 1974, had thrown it in a cupboard at home and never bothered to listen to it until a few weeks ago, when he was having a clear out. He told me I really needed to listen to it, that he'd tracked me down by making inquiries at Abbott's living home, where they'd given him my address. Curious of what was on the tape, I put it into my hi-fi and hit play. Well, I got the shock of my life when I heard Dad's voice coming out of those speakers. It was just like he was in the room with me.
Testing, testing. Hello. It is 15th, 1974. My name is Eric Gillen of Zanesville, Ohio.
I am 75 years old.
If you are listening to this recording, then you will know that I have already begun the journey back to that lonely place of forgetfulness. I know that some of you have doubted the stories I have told in recent weeks, so I hope that this recording will serve to document not only the events of that fateful night of October 18th, 1973, but also to try to put into words how my life has been changed. I know that my son Will has been especially frustrated with my explanation. The thing is, I still don't have all the answers, and I can only explain what happened from my point of view. Up until a few weeks ago, my world was a constant puzzle, one that no matter how hard I tried, I could never solve. But what I thought had been lost forever in the mists of memory was miraculously recovered and brought forward into focus from that fuzzy, distant place. The lens of confusion was removed. Edges that had been softened were sharpened, and I was once able again to taste the bite of a mind as it swallowed every last living detail with relish. I just didn't know how long I'd remain in the light of clarity before the old ghosts returned to pull me back into the fog. I think Will and I both knew that time was a commodity in short supply, that this temporary clarity would be lost at any moment, scrambled again into meaningless fragments, swirling around in my head as a goldfish in a bowl. But what a gift to find myself reflected in Will, to reacquaint myself with my own son after all these years, to reminisce about the old days without the random reshuffle of old age that the illness had given me. You know, I still remember that fateful day at the hospital when they gave me the diagnosis. July 13th, 1965. That date is etched into my mind. It never faded, even when everything else did. I just turned 67 a couple of weeks earlier. Nancy, my wife, had grown increasingly concerned about my behavior. She called it my clumsy phase, walking into things, tripping up, knocking things over, little accidents that I thought nothing of, that kept happening one after the other, throwing me off kilter and affecting my confidence. I grew confused about what was happening to me, which only served to make the situation worse. Words that had readily come to mind were now harder to find, as if they were playing a game of hide and seek. I'd misplace things all the time, too. Put something down and it would be gone. I'd blame the playful ghost or on the dog, but Nancy knew. She knew something was seriously wrong and that I was just in denial. She was the one who suggested I go see the doctor, and after she'd harassed me enough, I eventually did, which led to tests and eventually an MRI. We went to get the results on that sunny summer July day. Everything seemed so still, so peaceful. There was no breeze. It was like the world was holding its breath. It was baking hot, and I could feel beads of sweat running down my back as we sat side by side in Dr. Stewart's office as he explained the results of the tests and where it would all lead. Afterward, I remember feeling a strange sensation of relief and terror. The tests had confirmed the worst, that I had early onset Alzheimer's. Later at home, Nancy broke down. I can still see her eyes full of tears as the reality of the situation washed over us like a tidal wave. Eventually, we told the rest of the family, including my son Will and his wife Jackie, which was really hard. From that moment on, it was like there was this feeling that the sands of time were running down. Doctors told us there was nothing we or they could do to prevent the inevitable. God, how we tried to just get on with whatever time we had left by living just as normal life as we could. I hope with all my heart that doctors of future generations have a wider understanding of this disease than they do now, that there will exist at least some kind of protocol or something to delay the devastating symptoms. But for me, my wife, and my son Will, it was a waiting game. As the next few years rolled by, there was a noticeable decline in my ability to remember everyday things. I started to refrain from social situations for fear of making a fool of myself. I could no longer enjoy the things which used to give me pleasure. I'd get tied up in my thoughts, caught up in the moment, unable to break free from the pull of memory. It was as if I had wandered into a vast sprawling forest of trees whose arms stretched out to intertwine with each other, creating a beautiful, complicated, kaleidoscopic canopy that was so easy to be bedazzled by. Each of those trees was a container for a specific time in my life, each branch a memory, and each leaf a word, a name, a place, a feeling. And the wind would cruelly blow those leaves into the air, where I could no longer hold on to them. Sometimes the distant past would be blown up in front of my eyes in an instant. I'd be back on the streets of my childhood, dragged along by my mother to Duggan's grocery store, or perhaps getting a crew cut at Harper's Barber's. A memory I often found myself returning to was taking young Will to Clapper's confectionery store. I could almost smell the hit of candy as we walked in and see the thrill of his little face. I might be partway through making myself a cup of coffee and suddenly find myself sitting at a desk trying to construct an electromagnet back in Mr. Alsop's science class in ninth grade at Lash High School. The rush of emotion of being both surprised and confused, of gazing at faces I hadn't seen in over 50 years. Memories became traps that I would fall into and be unable to pull myself out of. I just kind of let them play out in my head, waiting for them to literally derail themselves, which they would inevitably do. Sometimes, though, memories might just jump tracks. One second I'd be a young man gazing up into the dark firmament on a cold winter's night at Putnam Park Hill, overwhelmed by the beauty and complexity of the universe, wondering intently on what kind of life might be out there beyond our planet. Then, without warning, I was walking down an ash and laurel-lined avenue toward the grand brick edifice that was the Good Samaritan Hospital, my heart beating out of my chest and my stomach turning cartwheels. That hospital holds particular emotional significance for me for two reasons. Firstly, It was the place where I first met Nancy. You see, back in the summer of 1917, I had a little accident. I was 19 years old and was riding my bicycle back from my friend Tom Potts' place. He lived out west of the city near Liking River. Well, I was just turning onto the newly paved West Pike when one of them newfangled automobiles comes veering straight toward me, knocking me sideways clean off of the saddle and onto the ground, busting my wrist in the process. Seems the driver, a young chap, had only just learned to drive and was still a bit shaky. Well, he was awful apologetic, offering to drive me straight to the hospital where I had to have my arms set in plaster. The nurse that attended me that afternoon was Nancy Miller. I instantly fell for her warm smile and striking blue eyes, and plucked up the courage to ask her on a date. Of course, I've always held that cherished memory of our first date in my mind, even at the height of my illness many years later. But now, if only for a short time, I can vividly recall everything. Our walk along the Muskingum on that bright July day. Sparks of sunlight bouncing on the water. How we chatted so easily, like we'd known each other for a lifetime. All the fears we had of America entering a war that had been raging across Europe seemed to fade away as we talked about our hopes and dreams for the future. She, of her duties at the hospital, her love of caring for people, and a dream of eventually raising a family. Me, of my ambition to get into a skilled, well-paid job using my hands. Since leaving school, I'd been working on my dad's farm, and while this served a purpose, and I'd been grateful to him, he wasn't really able to pay me a full wage. What I needed was to become independent and find a job that I could grow into. Nancy and I began dating regularly over the next few months, though we always had the threat of America's entry into the war over our heads, which eventually manifested toward the end of that year. I was drafted over to France early 1918. Nancy's letters to me during this time remained my only saving grace and kept me from losing myself in the misery and needless waste of life I saw every single day. Of course, my experience in France during the war are times I'd rather not remember. But this effect I've been experiencing is not selective. It's either all or nothing. As such, and because of the trauma I experienced, I simply chose to ignore that time altogether. All that is important is that I survived and made it back home in one piece. When things settled down some, I found a job as an unskilled laborer at Zanesville Mold on Muskingum Avenue. The company specialized in making molds for glass bottles. The founder, Mr. Barnes, told me if I worked hard and paid attention, I'd be crafting molds by hand in no time. A highly skilled job that paid handsomely for the time. He was right, of course. And within a few short years, I was one of his most skilled and trusted employees. I would remain loyal to that company and never had reason to look anywhere for employment. There are so many other milestones I could mention from my life. Things that are now so vivid in my mind that I can almost reach out and take them by the hand. Day days that were long after celebrated as birthdays or anniversaries, but were once the proudest, most profoundly happiest times of all. One such day in the fall of 1920, when the sun-drenched stained glass windows of Putnam Presbyterian Church threw a magical light onto the congregation as Nancy walked down the aisle toward me. A golden confetti of leaves falling in slow motion as we walked into the sunlight as man and wife for the first time. Another moment of clarity and realization, when my life changed forevermore, was the day I looked deeply into my newborn son's blue eyes and saw reflected back a chance to be a better version of myself and give him the chance of a life full of love and opportunity. Also, it has to be said, I was scared witless by the responsibility that lay ahead. Then there were days that would shape my view of reality, build my beliefs, and inspire me into my own life. One such day happened when I was just 7 years old. My dad took me with him to visit his farmer friend, Thomas Inman, of nearby Taylorsville, since renamed as Philo, near Duncan Falls and about 8 miles from Zanesville. Thomas and my dad had been friends since school and had been in touch through the years. Anyway, I was busy playing with my cast-iron horse-drawn steam fire engine when I overheard Tom mention something about a fireball in the sky and a strange spaceman. Intrigued, I stopped playing and asked him what he was talking about. Tom looked over at me, smiled excitedly, and asked me if I wanted to hear the strangest of stories. Of course, I replied yes. And warning me, he asked, did I scare easily? Bravely, I told him, hell, I wasn't scared of anything. So Tom sat me down and began telling me of something that happened to him and his boy some 32 years earlier in the last week of March 1873. They were walking home one evening when Tom saw a blazing object high in the sky, heading straight for the ground, which made a loud roaring noise. It struck the road a short distance from them, flickering with flames before eventually smoldering into darkness. I thought it was just a meteor or something, Tom said to me. But then, out of the darkness came the figure, dressed in a suit of black and carrying some kind of lantern. He walked a few paces, got into some kind of buggy, and without any noise or engine or horses, this object took off at high speed down the highway and vanished. Tom had no idea what it was, other than it came directly from the heavens. Well, I was awestruck and gobsmacked. I looked over at my dad, who raised his eyebrows and gave me a blank expression. He didn't seem as impressed with Tom's story as I was. He told me on the way home that darkness can sometimes play tricks on a man. But my imagination was fired up, and for the next few days I kept wondering what on earth that strange figure could have been, where it had come from, and what in the world was that contraption it sped off in? Many years later, I discovered that Tom had told local historian and journalist William Alexander Taylor the story, who in turn wrote to the editor of the New York Herald, resulting in a short piece that eventually appeared in the newspaper on April 6th, 1873. The day Tom told me this story is where I trace my interest in science fiction, space, and the unknown. It started me on a question that I'm still trying to answer today. I began to look up into the night sky with new wonder and awe of its mystery. For Christmas that year, Santa bought me a beautiful pair of German-made Turlux binoculars, and I began learning my way around the heavens when clear skies permitted. In 1910, age 12, my dad took me to a special public opening at Macmillan Observatory on Columbus University campus to celebrate Halley's Comet being visible in the sky. The observatory housed a magnificent 12.5-inch refractor, which we waited 2 hours in line to look through, being eventually treated to a glorious view of the comet and its spectacular tail, which would be indelibly printed into my memory. On October 30th, 1938, Will and I listened with some interest to the Mercury Theater radio play of War of the Worlds, produced by Orson Welles. Up until about halfway through, we, like many others, thought that it was real. As I grew older, I noted a steady rise in reports of strange lights in the sky, both in newspapers, radio, and eventually TV. There were the Foo Fighters that Allied pilots saw in the skies during the war, Pilot Kenneth Arnold's sighting of a group of flashing objects near Mount Rainier in 47. The Army claimed they had captured a flying saucer in Roswell in New Mexico. Film of strange craft over Great Falls, Montana in 1950. A V-shaped formation of lights over Lubbock in 1951. Sightings and radar contacts in Washington, D.C. in 52. Goblins and green men witnessed by 11 people in a farmhouse in Hopkinsville in 1955. And in 1957, the Kirkland Air Force Base sighting, to name but a few of many. In 66, I read Betty and Barney Hill's book, The Interrupted Journey, describing how they claimed to have been abducted by aliens in rural New Hampshire in 1961. I read the whole thing in one sitting, and then I read it again. At any opportunity, no matter what the weather, I was out under the night sky, looking, searching, and hoping to catch a glimpse of something, anything unusual. I saw shooting stars, meteors, and all kinds of specks of light, but I never saw anything large or strange enough to put down to outside influences. But that never stopped me. I just figured you had to be out there just to have the intent. When the illness began having a real impact on my physical and mental ability, I was still able to get out and spend time in nature with Nancy's help. And even though the world I once knew was becoming a jumble, I never once lost my place in the night sky. However, there were darker days ahead, and one of those days came without warning on May 15th, 1970. It was a glorious spring day. I had been sitting in the garden, sun-worshipping, daydreaming, tapping into the energy of spring. It was mid-morning when Nancy went off to the shop for some groceries. She gave me a peck on the cheek, smiled, and said she'd fetch something special for lunch. I fell into a deep sleep and woke up hearing the doorbell ringing. It was the police. Nancy Nancy had collapsed on Main Street and suffered a sudden cardiac arrest and had been rushed to the Good Samaritan. By the time Will and I arrived, I knew it was too late and that she had gone. Stricken with grief and parted from my one true love, only served to put me in an even worse position to fend off the illness. In a few short months, confusion was pretty much my normal state of being, and my health began to deteriorate. Will, bless him, did his best to keep me from the inevitable, but I was becoming a danger to myself. My neighbors on Jordan Avenue would increasingly find me wandering around in a state of dazed confusion and would kindly coax me back into the house, reporting my movements to Will. He would then have to make the short journey from nearby Avondale, where he lived, to come and check on me. Sometimes I'd be adamant that Nancy wasn't dead, and have angry outbursts with him, unable to understand why he didn't understand. On other occasions, I was just a young boy and just wanted to go home to Mom and Dad. Many times, though, my lifelong interest in all things science fiction would play tricks on my mind, bending my reality. I think the realization that something had to be done hit Will when things took a serious turn one night in November that year. I had convinced myself that a flying saucer was hovering over my house. This was nothing new for me. It was a common theme that my neighbors were more than familiar with, a delusion created by the illness affecting my brain, making me paranoid into the bargain. A few times, I even called local police and reported that I was being surveilled by extraterrestrials. To my mind, I was being stalked and targeted by aliens from another world who didn't have my best intentions at heart and had to find a way to escape. It was quite late when I quietly crept out of the house and proceeded to walk to Sharon Avenue in the direction of Pioneer Park. All this, and I was wearing nothing more than a pair of pajamas and slippers. I must have been quite a sight, walking stick in hand, constantly looking over my shoulder to see if I was being followed. But somehow, though, I made it to the park without drawing any attention to myself. What I thought I was gonna do in that dark, foreboding park at that time of night, I don't know. Of course, now I can remember every feeling of fear and detail with the hindsight of a clear head. I wandered the park alone and afraid of what might be in the sky above me. My heart and mind racing. Was that something in the sky? A light coming down not far from where I was standing? I panicked and began hobbling down along a grassy knoll as fast as I could. Next thing I knew, the ground was coming toward me, and then blackness. Luckily, I was found by a man walking his dog who raised the alarm. I'd badly twisted my ankle falling down a steep embankment and blacked out. When I came to, I began calling out and got the dog's attention. That whole sorry episode was enough to convince poor Will that something must be done. It was simply too dangerous for me to live on my own. Even if I did have regular help during the day, I now needed 24-hour care. How ironic that the one thing that had supplied me with so much enjoyment, excitement, and mystery was now putting me in danger of myself. After spending that Christmas with Will and his family, I was moved from my home of some 45 years into Abbott's senior living home on Greenwood Avenue. Initially, I was angry with Will. In my mind, I couldn't square away how he could betray me by putting me in that place. I didn't realize what I now know, that he was doing his best to keep me safe, protecting me as I protected him when he was a child. Eventually, my health started to improve a little. I'd still get confused, but the paranoia had gone, a blessing and testament to the care around me that I was receiving. Nearly every day I would have visitors to the home. Will, his family, and other friends would come by with gifts, memories, and plenty of love. Sometimes I would recognize them, other times not. I was taken for walks in the grounds outside, and when I was having a good day, I would still look up at the sky with wonder. What I needed most was familiarity. I needed the people, memories, and objects that had meant the most to me in my life to form a protective shield around me. I only realize now that Abbott's home gave me that and so much more. Friday, October 26, 1973, was like every other day at Abbott's. Will came to see me in the afternoon, just as he did every few days. I listened attentively as he read From the Earth to the Moon. I cherished the times when he took the time to read to me. There was no greater gift that he could give me, and I never wanted him to stop. After he left, I napped, had dinner, and listened to the radio. Outside, the sky had grown dark and rain had begun falling. Around 9, I was helped into bed and listened to the sound of the wind and rain until I fell asleep shortly after. My next memory is of a brilliant white light shining in my eyes. There seemed no place in my soul that it could not see. Then there rose up in my ears a deep, womb-like bass whose resonance enveloped my entire being. White then slowly changed to a deep red that seemed rooted in my physical flesh. I began to feel the blood in my veins tingle with a vibrant magnetic energy as the bass rose with a richer boom-like buoyancy that echoed from one ear to the other. From red to sunset orange, the pitch shifted again similar to that of a dialing tone on a telephone. 100 different ideas ignited in my head simultaneously, and my brain struggled to keep up. Then a yellow tide washed in with a brighter, higher vibration that fizzed and crackled like electricity. It was as if a spark of confidence ran through me. From a sandy shoreline, I was transported back to a thick forest green. The tone rose up to meet me in my heart, where I experienced a warm feeling of earthly love and connection. The next audible shift came, and I felt my own voice joining in an expression of unison as the color palette changed the sky blue, leaving me with a sensation that I was floating on air. The whistle-like quality of the next tone seemed to serve to clear a path of perception, to melt all doubt. Its radiant indigo hue offered an assurance and guiding light ahead. Lastly, the canvas within my head was painted a deep purple, and an etheric, angelic note began playing in my ears. I experienced a calm sense of understanding and felt myself as part of something familiar and infinite. I have no idea how long each of these changes through the spectrum of colors lasted in real time. Even though I seemed to be awake inside of a dream, there was no sense of time. It simply could not be measured. It may have been seconds or as long as hours. I suppose with the hindsight of time and some deep thought, I do know that what it felt like was I was being played with, that I was the instrument that some intelligence was tuning. The cycle of ever-increasing harmonics using color and sound to prepare me for what was about to happen. Because eventually, everything faded to black, and I slowly opened my eyes into the dark room. The sound of the rainstorm outside returned to my ears. I glanced over at the bedside clock. It was 2:15 in the morning. Something caught my eye outside of my window, high in the sky. A bright light was moving slowly across the sky. I squinted and tried to focus on it harder. It was pulsating, almost in time with my own heart, which I could feel in my chest. I watched as it carried on moving, and then it came to a stop. What happened next extinguished any doubt in my mind that what I was experiencing was something natural or man-made. In a second, it flared up 10 times as big before returning back to the original state and dropping quickly down towards the ground where it vanished from sight. I knew then, with complete clarity of mind, what I must do, even though the reality seemed impossible. I rose myself off the bed, put on my slippers, and grabbed my raincoat from the wardrobe. With my walking stick in hand, I opened the door to my room and slowly made my way down the corridor toward the entrance of the home. Of course, I shouldn't have been able to just walk out of that place at that time of night. But some minutes later, I found myself out in the teeming rain. How this came to be, I don't know. Was the alarm system disabled by a power cut caused by the storm? I just don't know. What I did know was exactly where that light had come down. I walked east along Greenwood Avenue for around 30 minutes in driving rain. My only compulsion was that no matter what, I had to get to where that light had descended. With not a soul on the streets, I walked right past Greenwood Cemetery until I eventually made it to Mount Olive Cemetery, about a mile from the home. Leaving the highway, I entered the darkness of the cemetery. I had a small pocket torch that I took out to light my way. I knew exactly where to go. I took the winding circular path that led around an island of graves and eventually found myself on the other side, where I stopped and looked down. There, at my feet, she lay, my girl, Nancy Rosemary Gillen, died May 15th, 1970. Beloved wife to Eric Gillen, devoted mother to William Gillen, forever in our hearts. As I read those words, in this place that I had come so many times before, where I had cried and laid flowers, I felt a surge of static electricity raise the hairs on my neck. Even though I had long believed that the body was only a container for the soul, that our life force, the spark of divine energy that makes us who we truly are, can never be extinguished, I still felt that this place, where her body now rested, retained a connection to who she once was. I looked up, realizing that the rain was no longer falling, and that the wind had stopped blowing the trees, which were peacefully still. It was as if someone had flicked an imaginary switch to turn off the sound effects. I stood there, rooted to the spot. Then, in the middle of my head, I heard what I thought was a voice. "Do not be afraid," it said. "You are in no danger." There was no accent, no intonation or inflection in those words. They were just delivered in an unemotional, monotonous way. There was something about that voice that felt inhuman, almost machine-like. I was told to calmly turn around. In the horseshoe of trees in front of me, there was a white, luminous orb about the size of a human adult. It was rotating at quite a speed, and at its edges was throwing off sparks in arcs of light. The glow of the object cast an atmospheric shadow on the sentinel of trees that stood around it, and despite its movement, it made no sound. The voice told me that it had picked this place because it held an emotional charge for me, that it was this energy of love and dedication that it had used to bring me there. Completely calm and unfazed, I tentatively took a step toward the sphere. More words in my head, but this time the voice was very familiar. It was Nancy's voice, or a very good emulation of her. As I continued walking, it explained that all electromagnetic radiation was light, though humans could only perceive a very narrow band of this light from our eyes, but that one day humans would evolve to be able to perceive all light, and with that would come the ability to expand and understand so much more about the energy of life and death, affording us the ability to communicate with souls that had passed from one state of being to the next. By now, I had gotten as close to the orb as I physically could. It was truly mesmerizing as it continued to spin, and I got the impression it was generating an immense amount of energy. The monotone voice continued. I was told that part of the life force energy that was once Nancy had been watching over me, that it was this energy of love and concern that had called out across the vast spectrum of light. Whatever it was, it told me it was unable to reverse the current state of my bodies, as that was part of my fate, my learning experience in this life, but that it was able to give me a temporary reprieve so that I may once again have clarity of thought and access to my memories. "Yes, yes," I shouted in the dark, and then I quickly realized I couldn't verbalize this answer. It had to resonate in my head telepathically. And as soon as it did, a small ball of light flew out of the larger orb and stopped inches from my face. My eyes were now transfixed on this orb. I felt its mass expand to envelop my body, and I lost all sense of where and who I was, of the here and now. There was only the moment, as I became translucent with light, as light as a light wave itself. How long this lasted, I have no idea, but eventually I regained a sense of proportion, of having something underneath me, and just as the light had exploded, it faded away to leave total darkness. When my eyes adjusted, I realized I was back in my room at Abbott's, lying on top of my bed, in my raincoat, soaking wet. I turned to look at my clock. It was 4 a.m. in the morning, and outside, I could hear the rain. I rang my bedside alarm for assistance. Of course, I tried to explain it all to Will over and over again, as it seemed my renewed clarity was not enough on its own to convince him that something amazing had happened. But no matter how hard I tried, he just went on and humored me as best as he could. But as the days passed and pumpkins turned into Christmas trees, I began to realize that trying to convince him of the truth was useless, and that in the grand scheme of things, it didn't really matter. What mattered most was being able to sit and talk again, and to remember. A few days ago, one of the nurses was cleaning my room when she found the cassette recorder Will had gotten me for Christmas 2 years ago, and it occurred to me that I might utilize it to make a permanent record of the whole story again. For the record. For future generations. For the hell of it. Perhaps as one last chance to leave Will and my grandson something they can ponder over as they in turn grow old. So that is what I have done here. I hope whoever listens to this gets something from it. All I can say is that I have told everything as exactly happened.
This is Eric Gillen.
Signing off. Goodbye.
I have listened to that recording many times since I found it. God, I missed hearing his voice. But with every listen, I know more and more, with every fiber in my body, that my dad was telling the truth, and how wrong I was to ever doubt him. For that, I'm sorry, Dad. So sorry. But as he said at the end, what was most important was those few months, that last Christmas. It was the best gift I could ever have received, because shortly after, the illness took back its hold. On Sunday, September 8th, 1974, my dad died of pneumonia. He was buried next to Mom in Mount Olive Cemetery. Yesterday, I went there and I had a good old chat with them both about all of this, and I got some things straight, let's say. But you know, apart from all the magic of this story, there is one other aspect that just floors me. The fact that this recording made it into my hands at all. You see, when Dad died, Abbott's gathered all of his possessions for me to collect, and for one reason or another, the tape got separated from the recorder and was put aside with other things to go to a flea market in town. What a gift to have it back after all these years, to hear my dad's voice again. You know, I once told him there were no such things as UFOs, and I remember him staring deep into my eyes and telling me, in no uncertain terms, well, What do you think an angel is then?
It was a stormy night in Ohio, and the rain was really coming down. An old man said he saw an angel high above a sleepy town. Well, they said there couldn't be no angels out flying on a night like this. And tell us, have you seen any UFOs, old man? Old man said, what do you think an angel is? And tell us, have you seen any UFOs, old man? Old man said, what do you think an angel is? It was a stormy night in Ohio, and the rain was really coming down. An old man said he saw an angel high above a sleepy town.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Please subscribe if you liked what you heard, and be sure to check out my Substack blog, Letters from Storyville, at nicktreadwell.substack.com.